everybody. We're back. Welcome to The Gods Will Not Save You, The Wire Revisited. I'm Willie.
Hey, everyone.
It's Jakob. Welcome back to the podcast where we do a deep read into the hit HBO show, The Wire, and we're here back. We're here again to talk about season 3, episode 8, Moral Yesterday. Moral Midget. Tree.
I was wondering if you were gonna get sensitive about that. If you want to donate, anchor.fm/thegodswillnotsaveyou/support. Y'all know what to do. Thank you very much to all of our supporters so far. We love you. Give us 5 stars and nice reviews on the podcast platform.
And yeah, so getting started in.
Yeah,
Amsterdam, which is going to be highlighted, this episode
quite a bit.
Yeah, it's spiraling out of control and it's a huge mess.
We have a guy, he's overdosing and people are debating what to do with him to get him back to a good state of mind. And like any good friends, they suggest the ice on the balls technique.
There you go.
And that, the jury's still out on whether or not that'll bring someone back from the brink of an overdose. But it's nice to see that he has friends who cares. But overall, this whole Amsterdam thing is just, it's getting to be a bit of a mess. Bunny's experiment is going a little more haywire than he would have expected. Didn't necessarily think all the things through. He impresses the deacon by showing him the regular or like the usual suspects for open air drug markets. And he's pretty shocked that, there's birds chirping. But yeah, things are kind of spiraling out of control and they're trying to think of strategies of, what to do. Meanwhile, lots of dealers are getting robbed and there's some infighting on all the territory. And now the irony of the whole situation is that some of the dealers are wanting more of a police presence.
Yeah, nice twist. But anyway, so the dealer who, they're getting robbed. Before that, though, he's trying to be social with people coming through the pit, and there's like a white lady or white girl in the backseat, they're making a buy. It's an interesting aside or, background right on that story, because there's, always this tale of, when you're going through the Wire trivia with family or friends, like, did you know that there's a girl who's, in one season she's buying drugs, then she's a prostitute, then she's at like a NA meeting,
right.
And I've always been like every rewatch I'm like, man, I'm a fraud. I mean, but yeah, you kind of confirmed that this kind of was my suspicion going into our talk about this episode, like what this is the most kind of obvious interaction with some suburban looking or white girl,
right.
Or like this could be the plot line that kind of develops into that. A bit of nuance that, of course, the show is famous for, and you confirmed it. So, you kind of mentioned also the irony of the dealers who are getting preyed upon. They've been told, you can't defend yourself, no violence, as far as weapons are concerned.
Right.
And, it's obviously the word is out, for the stick up artists or crews. It's easy pickings and they're, they're feasting off of their profits and personal, jewelry and everything like that. So I don't know. You kind of, you said it pretty succinctly, like you normally come through with, the tight analysis, but I don't know, anything else about that interests you or just kind of like the twist there?
Well, I like it how, the dealer who wants to make a complaint to the police ends up, going down to the station with a few other guys and they're talking with Herc while they're using the identikit to kind of do a sketch of the robbers. And Herc gets kind of drawn in to the
yeah,
like the fun of technology in this moment, and they start kind of like messing around with like different faces and what they could look like. Even kind of like pissing off Officer Colicchio in the process. Like they were both kind of like allies and standing together against this like whole experiment. And but the difference is that Herc is like so thick and like dumb that like something is just like I don't know, like a moth to a flame with like this like weird technology that can make him like create funny faces or whatever. But Colicchio like actually has like real problems like with the whole process of, you know, what's going down with Hamsterdam and wants to stand against it in any way. So to see her kind of like goofing off or goofing around with that, like he's like, he's not 100% committed to being an adversary like I am. Like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah. Also, didn't in literally the first episode when they're talking about, you know, typewriters and write-ups and all that, and Kima's laying into Herc and Carver about computers, and she's basically like, oh, if you had a computer, you know, all you do is just look at porn, right? And he's basically trying to do some, like, animation, right? Know? Like, you know, the features on a woman and all this and that. So
one of the guys even asks, like, hey, does this thing do asses too?
She looks like a pie tin with hair now, yo.
Yeah, Herc is no prez with the technology. That's for damn sure.
Yeah. All right, man. We're sticking to this outline. But I don't know. Like, since you're talking about Colicchio, do you just want to come back to Omar and stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
So Colicchio, like, yes, Colicchio is very incensed by the entire Hamsterdam experiment, and Carver's, you know, obviously changing.
He's evolving.
Yeah, he's evolved. His ideology is definitely kind of, he seems more open-minded with his approach, right? And he's, you know, showing shades of being more of a mentor to the youngsters and doing all that stuff we talked about. Check out our previous episodes about his wealth tax and Kami Carve and all that. But they get together under the, it seems like the Western District drinking in the drinking spot under a freeway or the overpass, and kind of a much different tone from one other major interaction between those cops in season one, episode two, I think, where they all got drunk and did the, brutality in the towers.
The guy who plays Colicchio, Benjamin Bush, he's a former Marine who served in Iraq. He played a drastically different role in Generation Kill, who is kind of like on top of things and not part of like all the bureaucratic and chain of command fuck ups that were present in that show. Just like further proving Simon's kind of MO to do opposites a lot of the time, cast actors in opposite roles from roles they played in previous series. So pretty interesting to see him kind of stretch there in like a really tightly coiled, rage-filled, excellent performance. So check out Generation Kill if you guys haven't already, to see him in a different light. And it's also just a great show on its own.
Can't remember him at all from Generation Kill, so I guess, yeah, I'm a casual, it's been a long time. But so he's much more, like you said, astute and like, or as far as just like straight,
right
it's not like he's not someone who's going to lose his cool in front of his commanding officer and threaten to beat civilian in Iraq, as He's wanting to beat on the unemployed hoppers or just, you know, kids in Amsterdam right in front of Colvin's. But, I mean, it's like, hey, you know, Colicchio, if you wanted to beat on some kids, you missed your chance. They're here now in Amsterdam. I mean, he obviously didn't have enough fun when they were rounding everyone up.
Right.
But nothing really happens. I mean, it's just an interaction later where Colvin's kind of doing the whole... like, hey, are we on the same page thing? You know, where are you at, Anthony?
Right.
That's what it says in my, it's in my notes.
Yeah.
It's in my notes. I hope that's right. Colvin and, you know, the Deacon, they're spending probably the most time. I mean, they're spending the most time to date. And like, yeah, Colvin had kind of taken the Deacon to a corner, you know, we presume a notorious corner. I don't think he mentioned Mount and Fayette in his worst, you know, corners, but he wanted to use this as an example. Like, have you ever seen Mount and Fayette this quiet? Like, you know, so it's pretty tranquil. Tranquil?
That's a good word.
It's very tranquil. There's, you know, birds chirping, kids playing. And then he asked him, like, have you ever seen it this quiet? And, okay, I wanted to mention something. I know, you see, I hyperlinked another. I layered some notes in, Willie. This is, like, I never done this before.
This is next level.
So this is just from an article. You know, I've talked about it. It's David Simon's great piece on, you know, Little Melvin and that whole outfit when it kind of fell down. Easy Money, The Anatomy of a Drug Empire, which we've cited a bunch here. And if you haven't read that and you're a huge fan of the show and this podcast, you got to.
Yeah, it's a must read for sure. There's
free PDFs online. You could, you know, just Google it. Easy Money.
Yeah.
But so they're basically just running down like Little Melvin's character traits. And then there's one quote that stood out to me and kind of the intro, like the first page basically. It says, Little Melvin the gangster allegedly waving a machine gun in a Mount Street bar and threatening like, okay, this is where you're going to help me. Cagney or Cagney?
Cagney, like James Cagney?
There you go. So after, like Cagney on the screen to shoot everyone in the joint. And only days prior to the incident, he was hailed as Little Melvin the Citizen, speaking at the request of National Guard officials during the 1968 riots, urging a relentless crowd to go home. So that was, I sent you a picture once where he's like posing with the colonel right. or some high-ranking guy in the Maryland National Guard, Gelston, General. Maybe it was General. But anyways, yeah. So I don't know if there's like some symbolism in there where once upon a time, Little Melvin's wreaking havoc in a bar on Mount Street. I don't know if it's Fayette, but it's a pretty, you know, it's like a long street, but it's a small street.
Yeah. So
who knows, but it's quiet now. He's not threatening anyone, but who, you said James Cagney?
James Cagney.
Cagney? What was he like a... Was he a gangster? Like
he is like a movie star from like the 30s and 40s who always played gangsters and stuff. Like he was in Public Enemy.
Okay. Well, see? There you go, man. It's all connected. But yeah, I just thought that was funny.
Yeah.
But it's quiet now. It's quiet. And things change, though, when the Deacon gets his first full glimpse of Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And I don't know what you got.
I mean, there's like, if Melvin was around to see something like Amsterdam flourish, would he embrace that? Or would he be more like, because Marlowe is not really like taking part in the whole Amsterdam experiment. Would he be more of the mindset of like Marlowe that he wants to be like still kind of like part of the drug class or whatever. I kind of wanted to pick your brain about that. Yeah.
I don't think there's any, I mean, I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, he's kind of he seemed like an enigma in some ways.
Yeah.
Where he was really, I mean, maybe when he was younger, but I don't even, it seemed like, and we're going to talk about his, you know, prowess and gambling and being a pool shark and all that.
I mean, we see it in this episode.
It just seemed like way more of a someone like in the co-op in a way, you know, like a wholesaler type or something. Yeah. Like, he wasn't responsible for the day-to-day corner stuff or, you know, but I don't think he was ever, you know, really into it like that thick on the streets from what I've gathered, but you never know. So who knows? But I doubt he'd be anywhere near something like that. Yeah. You probably think it was like, he'd probably be like Omar, like this is a setup.
Yeah.
Cause he was like super straight. I mean, he never, not that like, you know, people who drink like Avon and then, I mean, Avon doesn't seem that interested really.
Yeah.
Either. He's just more true. For the beef, but you know, like he was like very disciplined, didn't drink really, I don't think he drank or smoked, or he was a vegetarian. He was like into physical fitness and just like, so
I mean,
I think more like Marla, but less like active.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing to think about. And that's interesting that you say that about the, alcohol abstinence, because, in the scene with Marlo and the honeypot Devon, he admits that he doesn't drink or dance. He doesn't do any of that.
There you go. So add little Melvin to his character composition.
Okay.
You know, along with, because he's also black, right? Like that's what he goes by, like Marlo's nickname. And that's when Melvin was having his resurgence after like one of his first big stints, he was like, I'm not little Melvin anymore. I'm black. Because he wore black all the time, I guess.
Nice. But
the Deacon says, he makes some great points.
Yeah.
He says, like, metaphorically speaking, you know, blind man and an elephant, there's, you know, great village of pain, and you're the mayor. So, I don't know, what are your thoughts on that interaction? To me, that's always stood out as such a great bit of dialogue between Bunny and the Deacon.
I mean, well, this is kind of a turning point in the way they're operating things, because he gives him the idea. I mean, he kind of criticizes his approach to a lot of things, but Bunny has a good friend in the Deacon that he could offer up some good advice on, like, possibly mitigating the damage of everything that's going on. So he kind of plants the seed for him to, you know, get some running water and needle exchange programs and condom distribution to make it more of like a full-fledged successful experiment, instead of just seeing like the fits and starts of how this could work properly with, you know, some usual drug corners being quiet and just absolute chaos happening on the other end of town. But at least there's going to be, you know, some public health protocols in place with his advice. So even if he was kind of shocked by the initial sight of like all this shit, he does have some really good advice on how to kind of like bring things together. And
what do you think about private institutions being utilized for the most part? Because I think that, I mean, they go to meet with the Hopkins guy,
right?
I mean, there is like maybe some. Like they seem like, I know you probably would only say this in a different country, but like NGOs type, or, you know, like, and outfits, you know? So I know there's like a lot is made about the gods and the institutions, but, and you know, Simon always talks about, you know, this is a show where unfortunately, you know, in our society, things in the marketplace are really determining things, and like our public institutions aren't serving those who really need it. So. Do you think that's like, you know, any commentary on that by just tapping into these huge, you know, private, you know, the private school that wields a lot of power in the city? Or is this just my like petty beef with Johns Hopkins? I mean,
you're onto something there, but ultimately we see the whole, in the end, we see the Amsterdam experiment fail rather miserably. And it's going to be like individuals from these large institutions who are going to be contributing to making the change, not the institutions as a whole, right? So there's just, he's just kind of like picking and choosing his all-star drug legalization team. So maybe that's something, like angle that David Simon was working with to try and show like, you know, there's good people and many different facets of day-to-day life, even if the machine they're working for is corrupted at the core.
Yeah. So let's talk. I mean, we want to talk about some characters in Amsterdam, but I know I kind of jumped ahead and mentioned the infusion of these private groups. And one of the guys was from Johns Hopkins in their public school of public health, right, and the way that they kind of met up was over a pool game, and you know who was there, kind of just casually laying the smack down on someone while negotiating future, work in the in Amsterdam and the disaster zone was the Deacon, of course. You know, like we talk about all the time, played by Little Melvin, who was a huge pool player and like pool shark back in the day. Also from Easy Money, there's like some really great stuff about Little Melvin, the gambler.
Yeah.
A teenage shark playing angles to perfection, clearing rack after rack against older, more experienced players. Colonel James Watkins, this guy's always brought up, remembered pulling Melvin from the pool hall as a kid and taking a wad of cash from his pockets to ask her, you know, his mother, if she knew he was betting a lot of money, she would say, I give him money to play. He always wins. So, man, you cannot win if you don't play, right? At least if you're Little Melvin playing pool as like a teenager on the avenue. But that's just hilarious too. The Colonel guy, James Watkins, like always brought up in all these stories. I mean, he's like West Baltimore again, probably not big, especially back in the, when was this? Probably the like, mid-60s. But yeah, he's a guy I probably talked about. I don't want to tarnish his name. He was like one of the highest ranking black members of the police force, but some corruption charges like bribery, narcotics trials. I mean we could have a whole conversation about that, but pretty crazy stuff that he was as like a, you know, someone like climbing the ranks like Carver or something, just what the future, like big, like the biggest kingpin in Baltimore history, you know, just as a kid interacting with him. So it's crazy.
Yeah. We also get more of a Cuddy's evolving storyline. And I thought it was interesting. The Deacon is kind of, giving him a little mini lecture in like the nicest way that he can, that maybe it's about surrendering yourself to something. And he refers to the cross around on his neck. And Cuddy says that he's not interested, which I think is like, at least for me, like whenever I see like movies or TV shows with like an ex-convict going like on the straight and narrow path, religion is always a thing that plays a part in their reformation or like rehabilitation or whatever. So it's just kind of refreshing to get like different shades of this story of someone, you know, redeeming themselves on like a really painful path, and he's not going to go down that road, which is something that is not shown regularly, is like in popular television, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know. You could tell me I'm crazy.
I pretty much have a similar reaction. I mean, it's I don't know if saying refreshing would be offensive, but yeah, I mean, I think it's cool. Like, especially he's working with the Deacon. I mean, it's Baltimore and the religious circles, you know, really, really prominent, as we're going to see, as far as the politics are concerned and all that. But yeah, it's like a personal journey. Just, he wants something bigger than himself in the form of just, you know, helping boxing. Others. Yeah, yeah. Boxing.
Yeah.
So in a way it is like, he is doing what people would call, you know, the Christian thing, but it's just in his own
it's
way.
It's a different shade. Yeah. From what people usually say.
We're both pretty, let's get secular. Cuddy's a non-believer, man. He's definitely going down. We got to take him on a field trip to Kentucky, to the Ark.
Oh, my God.
But, you know, it's cool that he's so steadfast in his belief, you know, in helping others, that he sees a really nice gym. And then they take him to where, you know, Roman finds a location, great location scout for a gym. It's just like a torn up warehouse. And he's like, no, man, this is my journey. And I was going to ask you, you know, there's kind of a theme we're going to talk about later with Stringer. It's like, is this his, crawl, walk, run?
Right. Exactly. Because, I mean, him and Stringer are in two totally different positions. Cuddy has had to like put his life on hold for 14 years. So I think he's gotten it into his head that he can't come right out of the gate, like,
yeah,
for lack of a better word, swinging. So he's going to have to like make some, you know, baby steps to reach his goal. But he seems kind of undeterred by that, which is really refreshing in this show. Seeing a lot of characters bite off more than they can chew, and they end up dying, getting killed.
Yeah, so much needed violence. No, but yeah, so just some thoughts there. But yeah, that's, yeah, it's a great analysis of that whole thing. But before we move on, I jumped ahead talking about the private institutions and all that stuff,
yeah,
as far as helping out in Amsterdam. But there was an appearance by someone pretty important to all of this, you know, and to the entire universe of The Wire, The Corner.
Oh, yeah, and that's right.
I didn't really catch it at first, I'm going to be honest. Look who appears in this episode, just in a really short, you know, clip.
Right, Fran Boyd, one of David Simon's personal heroes.
Yeah.
Makes a cameo appearance at the, what is it, condom distribution or needle exchange?
Yeah,
so it's like one of the services.
Yeah, I think she's at the needle exchange, but then the woman who kind of takes the, you know, center of the shot is giving out condoms to the prostitutes and the girls down there. And just for anyone who will take them, but, or for the girls to give to anyone, you know. Anyways, but
yeah, great appearance from Fran Boyd there. I can just imagine, you know, we saw on some of the credits that she had a lot to do with the sound design of the first season. I can just imagine that she brings a lot of authenticity to the set whenever she's involved. So it was great to see her. And I'm just like kind of like thinking in my head that for some reason, she's part of the reason why this season is so great.
Definitely, yeah. And
maybe even this episode.
Yeah. I mean, what must be going through her mind at the time, you know, in such a really harsh, you know, set design. I mean, the set design, everything's so authentic because it, you know, it is filmed in an abandoned strip of row houses in a neighborhood that's been blighted and probably has, you know, drug activity and when there isn't filming there and stuff, but you know, Amsterdam is such an extreme representation of that, and she's in the middle of it now, clean.
Yeah.
Talk about reform.
Yeah, I wonder if there's, like, any PTSD she is experiencing, like, if this is, like, painful, but...
Or therapeutic to be, like, helping out, even in a, you know, act, you know, in a setting where...
Exposure therapy.
Yeah. You know about psychology, I'm sure. Like, not because you're great. I mean, because you're, you know, a smart guy and your experience in life. But, I mean, that's a great term. Exposure, which is, this is what I'm supposed to say. Like,
isn't that's it new like to me. When you have, like, a fear of something that you just, like, get exposed to it little by little to gradually desensitize you or something.
Okay, so like the opposite of when Mari has someone on his show who's afraid of clowns and then like 10 clowns pop out and chase him around the studio.
Was that a real episode?
Yeah, he would do that all the time.
Clowns, wow. Damn,
or just like any guest, like I'm afraid of balloons. And then he's like, oh, really? And then from both sides of the stage, like comes out a guy with, you know, with like 50 balloons and then just like they freak out.
Isn't that just like extreme exposure?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. This is like what you're describing. This is a very like we're having like a like really, you know, like some poignant statements about Fran. So I'm like, remember Mari? I didn't have cable growing up. That's what I watched after I like get home from, you know, no fourth block and eat an entire Red Baron pizza. Anyways. Exposure therapy with Fran. That's a great point. Thanks for sharing.
No problem. But we have Bunny, you know, he's the poster child over at Comstat.
Yeah, Bunny is the star. 12% decrease. And, you know, the gods will not save you. We talk all things, you know, God related, except when it comes to, you know, Cuddy and his journey, because he's not into all that. But he says to Rawls and Burrell, maybe, you know, the gods were listening.
Yeah.
And you get, like, what do you think about that?
I mean,
God talk.
Well, it's just, if the gods are institutions, like Simon said, then Bunny is kind of trying to fuck the gods back, like Burrell suggested he might do in one of the earlier episodes. But the gods don't even know that they're being fucked right now, and they're gonna strike back with a vengeance.
Hasn't Simon talked about that? Like, if you mess with Zeus or whatever, you know, right, you're gonna get the bolt. You know?
Yeah.
So, brilliant stuff, man. Really. Only if the gods will not save you will you get God talk and no God talk.
Will you get divine takes like this?
Oh, man. All right. Enough. Yeah.
So we can go to the detail now.
Detail. It's all about the detail.
You have details. Some little information about Prez getting on his Geo, right?
I have no idea what he's talking about. He said something about 1440 Propane Road in Falls Church, Virginia. I couldn't figure that out. I mean, there's like, whatever. The point is they're on some crazy, you know, trail as far as Prez's ability to, you know, track everything. But I'm always like, whenever there's a major geo breakthrough, it's always the police. I'm just like, man, am I turning into a cop, Willie? Like, is that what's going to come from this? Someone's like going to randomly hear this and recommend them, like, hey man, you know, come check us out. It's just, you know, it's just a 2-year contract at the National Guard. You just spy on people here. Okay, maybe that's not the National Guard. FBI.
There's plenty of things you could do with your geo knowledge, I'm sure.
The point is, like, that's not where this is going. It's just like they're the ones who always think, I'm conflicted. They got interesting geo takes, and it's the police. I'm not supposed to be on their side. But anyways.
Well, Prez only started developing these skills after he was ostracized for partially blinding a kid, and he was kind of forced into a position where he had to, like, develop some skills that were useful for the detail.
It's like, you have no choice, Amish kid. You smacked another kid with a rake. Like, now you're just going to study these globes all day. That's right. But I want to help the barn. They have my streusel.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
But it's, you know, it's kind of like it's interesting that we see Prez kind of like at the peak of his abilities in this episode where, you know, he's making jokes about not being able to see like the license plate, but then he gets all goofy on it with Daniel saying, like, you know, sometimes you still scare me. Daniels was also teasing him that he knew everything about, like, how the Bernard was buying, like, all these burner cell phones. And he's like, well, were the cell phones to the right or the left of the cash register? Yeah. So it's like, you know, it's nice to see Prez at the top of his game and, you know, people teasing him, you know, lovingly, of course, because they realize he's become such a great asset. But this is kind of this is pretty much the last time we get to see him being an asset to the force, because he accidentally kills a cop in the next episode.
Yeah, I did not realize that. So, like, when we talk about spoilers, you know, as a label,
we're not fucking around,
because you spoil things for me, and I've seen the show multiple times. Because next episode, I swear, I would have been sitting there like, oh shit, this is where Prez kills the cop, man.
Yeah,
all the foreshadowing, and I would feel really stupid. But I'm gonna feel stupid anyways because, like, you mentioned it, I didn't even. But another thing, man, with this whole geo thing, you're like, oh, you're having a very Prez moment there. I'm like, no, don't, please, don't compare. I'm also he knows a lot about Track, the company where they're getting all these phones. You know, Track phones. Right. I mean, he's tracking them really well. But I was going to ask, have you ever had one of those? Because
no.
See, damn it. See, I have. And I was like, man, this is another thing I got in common with Prez. They're terrible, man. They're the worst. Like, I don't know why I had it, but when I met, you know, my wife now, when we first met, I had a track phone still. For some reason, I had gotten rid of. I don't even know if I had a smartphone and downgraded, or like some of my family had one, and then we just started using them.
Yeah,
it's just like it's terrible. My dad would always be like, "Why am I getting calls from this 916 number all the time, Sacramento? I don't live there." I'm like, because you have a track phone and they recycle numbers, and this person was really popular for some reason. So yeah, track phones are just terrible.
Yeah,
and I had to upgrade because like, does she think I'm like a sociopath or like a drug dealer? it was all bad, but.
Yeah, I'm glad you saved your marriage by
our future. And then I upgraded to a Metro where I just got a recycled number from them, and then now I just get debt collectors calling all the time asking for beep 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 Victor Cardenas.
Okay.
Anyways, he was never meant to leave the desk. He should have just stayed there.
Exactly.
You should have been looking at Catonsville, Laurel, Bethesda, Springfield, Virginia, and you should have stuck to Dumfries, dummy.
nice one.
By the way, I mean, we're going to talk about Kim Nulty's trip down south, but I mean, they talk about Dumfries at a certain point, and they got to drive 100 miles, blah, blah, blah. McNulty's all upset. But if they were talking about Dumfries, that's only about 70 miles from Baltimore. So once again, McNulty living in his, hyperbole or whatever you want to call it, just being a baby about it.
Yeah.
So pretty crazy, but all up and down the 95, man, they're just hitting all the stores. Bernard, he was disciplined, but not disciplined.
So Kima and McNulty head out to a variety of different liquor stores to see if there's any security cam footage of this guy buying all the cell phones. And once he discovers that it's Mondo Mart policy that they... is it Mondo Mart rewinds the tape, or is that the other one?
Yeah, it's a this is like one of the craziest things I've figured out about this show, Willie.
What?
The Mondo Mart clerk, who, that's why I said it's Daryl, it's Mondo Mart policy Davis, because he rewinds, we rewind the tape at least every week.
Right.
Yeah, he's like, but do you know, I sent you that crazy video. I'm assuming you watched it. Daryl Davis is this really... Well, he's really renowned, like world renowned for multiple things. He's a crazy boogie woogie, like jazz, like piano player, that style.
Yeah.
And he's also famous for converting dozens of KKK members.
That's right.
And I was looking at him like, who is this guy? I know him. I've seen him on like a TED Talk or a thumbnail and a podcast. he's like probably a local casting, because I mean he we're there visiting him at the Mondo Mart. I think that's already out by in Virginia, but maybe they're still in Maryland. I don't know. They were talking about Fredericksburg at the detail and all that, which is really far south. I mean, Dumfries looks like the farthest place they head south, which is in Virginia. But anyways, Daryl Davis met, like, his first interaction with these KKK members was at a bar out in Frederick, Maryland, which is like western, kind of heading out towards West Virginia almost in that way. But that's like, he was playing piano there and then met, you know, these KKK racist dudes who are like, oh man, I didn't know you could play like Jerry Lee Lewis. Like, I've never seen a black guy do it. He's like, well, he learned from black guys.
Yeah, seriously.
So, you know, he started hanging out with all these KKK guys and like eventually even deconverted or whatever, you know, helped with the transition of the Imperial Wizard of Maryland.
Yeah.
Insane.
So wild.
And he's in The Wire.
That's crazy. I didn't know that either.
This is nuts, man. It literally was one of these things where I had to message you, and this is why GChat exists, right? Like, okay, you know, if I GChat him this at like 1:30 in the morning, well, I can't sleep. That's not as weird as texting, but I'd probably text you anyways. just like you would at like 11 on a Sunday. Like, how was your weekend, bro? I'm like, okay, well, I'm on sleep mode. Like, damn. It was wild, man. I was all over the place.
It's funny. I typed in Daryl Davis Mondo Mart into Google, and yeah. the first result that popped up was from Reddit. It says Mondo Mart policy is to collect KKK hoods.
Oh man! See, yeah. Like, just when you think like, man, I've stumbled across. I mean, you know,
there's layers and layers. We're discovering things upon fourth and fifth rewatches. So.
I'm glad we did it, and I'm glad we're doing it, like, pretty, I mean, Reddit's fun, but, you know, it's also fun to discover and be like, oh, man, what does Reddit think about this? And then they got something even, I mean, you know, the internet's undefeated, but it's also good to, like,
right,
you know, we're, like, doing it old school.
Yeah. So we got Brianna, the seed was planted maybe an episode or two ago with Donette telling her that McNulty is kind of like snooping around, intimating that D'Angelo's death couldn't have possibly been a suicide.
What do you think about Jimmy's like comments and, you know, when he gets Brianna down to the homicide department? It's a pretty ruthless stuff.
I mean, it's all true though. Like, it's all accurate what he's saying about her, and that like, you know, she did kind of indirectly kill his son. But yeah, maybe it's a little harsh.
That's what I was gonna say. Could it be said that Mama murked him?
Yeah, I like that. But just as like Jimmy is getting too real with Brianna in that scene. We kind of see, as you say, like he's showing a little bit of his true colors in this episode. He's doing a little MAGA. He's going full MAGA in like a couple scenes. He made that Sikh joke to the cashier at the
Baba John. Was that a Sikh joke?
Well, he said, when I watched it, I was watching it with the closed captions, and he says, "Seek and you shall find." Oh. And they had S-I-K-H in quotation marks, which is why like the other guy like looked offended or pissed off about it. And then of course, when they get to, when they're at Dumfries, Virginia, and he's like trying to talk to the cops about, you know, possibly getting access to security cam footage, he launches into this whole like racist tirade about, you know, the ethnic makeup of Baltimore and all that, ostensibly like in an attempt to like kind of, you know, get him on his side and you know, work him so he can get some more information out of him before he's like horrified to learn that he's being kind of an asshole and that he has a black wife. So
man,
yeah,
but that is, I mean, of course that's nothing to do with him trying to game his way into the footage, right? That's Jimmy's racist? I don't know.
He's not racist. He has a black partner. No, yeah. That's not an excuse at all. But, it's just funny that automatically thinks that he's in Virginia. He has to like put on a racist face to get any work done. But like Virginia is like actually like it's getting pretty like, I mean, they're passing like pretty like bold progressive legislation nowadays about like, you know, drug reform and all this, like probably a lot more like sophisticated than he's giving it credit for. And I'm mostly speaking just from like the standpoint of like, oh, like I see in electoral politics, Virginia is like going more liberal or progressive or whatever. Like they can't be as racist as Jimmy thinks they all are.
I mean, but talking about racist faces or putting on a racist face in Virginia, isn't that literally what the, Democratic mayor with his black face.
Yeah, I spoke too soon.
I was like,
yeah.
What's his name? Ralph Northam.
Yeah, he did the horrible black. There's a horrible blackface scandal that came out about him. I spoke too soon.
No, I mean, it is true. I mean, they are pretty democratic down there, but that could mean who knows what.
Yeah.
It's a lot of different, you know, intentions. But, you know, it's just like the good old boys in the South. What do you expect? I mean, they're just, it's just like locker room face. No, it's pretty bad stuff. It's bad. But yeah, that is fun. I mean, now that you broach the subject, I mean, 20 years ago, right, Virginia, I don't know. I just feel like everything is pretty center, right, or
yeah.
Central. Like, it's Dumfries. They live in Dum-Dum. Oh. No, I mean,
yeah.
I'm trying to make a, you know,
it's,
shout out Young Moose.
Kim Nolte, they're having a weird moment in the hotel where they're kind of commiserating about, like, how to cheat on their wives, or, like, if they feel guilty about it, or what they would do to cheat on their wives.
But is that what, like, that is weird stuff, but also, like, is this, I mean, are we on the same page, kind of, like, do you know what I was getting at, also with the weird moment?
Well, like, McNulty's trying to, like, seduce her.
Yeah,
like,
right?
He's just shameless. Well, because she says, like, oh, I don't even have a quarter for the magic fingers, like, the vibrating bed or whatever, and McNulty is trying to step in at that moment, trying to be opportunistic or whatever.
Oh, that's what the... Magic fingers is a, you could, there's like hotels that have that,
like the bed that vibrates, right?
I don't know.
I think so. It's like a massaging bed or whatever.
Oh, okay.
All right, you want to move on to
let's do it. Yeah, let's get it rolling with the Barksdales.
Yeah,
we got Strang doing all sorts of crazy stuff.
Yeah, it's
property development. Marlowe's involved. They're all, it's all starting to they're yeah, some pretty combustible interactions, and they're, you know, getting closer to, like, really fatal face-offs here.
Right, yeah. So Stringer is involved with his whole thing with Clay Davis. He's pissed off that the development contracts are not moving fast enough, and at the same time, Avon is involving himself in a totally different crises with a figuring out how to hit back at Marlowe's crew for killing one of their own. So further exploring the kind of, like, dichotomy, or like the divergent paths that they're taking with their lives, and how examining how this is gonna, like, really wreck their friendship sooner than we might have expected.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess the divergent paths, you know, they're taking, obviously Stringer's buried in, you know, his mess with Krawcheck and the developers, and, you know, Chunky Coates is lurking. No idea what that even means. But, yeah, Avon, of course, is on the streets, and he's working on a master plan to ensnare Marlowe and, you know, lure him out with a woman, Devon, right?
Yeah, they got the honeypot.
They are also basically, yeah, mining details about Omar's family or his grandma at the same time, which is even Slim Charles kind of like, you know, what's going on with that, or like, yeah, both of them.
Yeah, well, because he says, like, oh, Trina with the big ass, and they go,
yeah, thanks. that clears everything up for me. That is like a pretty random, like. Oh, man. I mean, maybe I didn't think much of it, but now it's like, okay, now I know more about Big G. Yeah. And it's just like such a... It's like, hey, man, this guy, like, okay, he's acting, but maybe he's not the most experienced. And then let's just write in, you know? I mean, this whole Marlowe plot, like, what? I mean, I know you alluded to it, made a really, you know, sharp connection. Little Melvin didn't drink, and Marlowe doesn't either.
Right.
He doesn't do much of anything, but...
Yeah, go into the back of his Denali, GMC Denali, to fornicate. And I just, like, with Chris kind of just, like, standing watch outside of the SUV, like, waiting for them to finish up their dirty business. Like, that's gotta be one of the
dirty business.
That's gotta be, like, one of the most awkward, like, uncomfortable jobs, or, like, you know, duties of a job ever, where you have to, like, wait for your boss to finish you know, ejaculating or whatever. And it was, like, kind of similar to when Shamrock was, like, waiting outside for Stringer to, you know, finish up his talk with Donette.
His Yeah, it's Todd.
Yeah, but this is, you know, Avon and Stringer are both biting off more than they can chew, with Avon trying to take care of the two-pronged problem of Marlo and Omar at the same time, not even realizing that there's, you know, holes in his plot with Donette, and Stringer, you know, wanting to accelerate the development stuff. I don't entirely understand everything that's going on with all the logistics of that.
It's okay. No.
It's a little complicated. I mean... But, you know, Marlo, he doesn't drink. We see Stringer and Avon drinking, but Marlo is like way sharper and more on top of it, and, you know, pretty much exploits Devon for what she is offering at that time, knowing that she is part of like a larger plot to like ensnare him in a trap. So he's really the sharpest one of the bunch at this point. So, and he, you know, he has Snoop on the lookout,
yeah,
waiting at the lake trout to take notes on anybody's orders that come in there. And like, as soon as like someone comes in and orders four items, it raises her suspicions, and they find out that all along Donette was a honeypot, and
Devon,
yeah, damn it, sorry.
That's just, yeah, the crazy like curveball, having someone that they would never suspect as being a part of Marlo's crew, you know, just staking it out and stuff like that. But then also it's like, how does Avon survive? I mean, like that's like a sawed-off shotgun. And again, you know, we know a lot about firearms on this podcast. Cars and guns, man.
We're the premier experts. But
yeah, I mean, it's just like a blast that close. I mean, he gets shrapnel or like glass in his arm and buckshot or whatever, but the other guy gets like, wouldn't it just blow off both their heads? Seems crazy. But also, it's like, did they miss? They missed kind of their shot. I mean,
yeah, I couldn't tell you on the accuracy of that
forensics of that sawed-off weapon.
Yeah, I'm not the guy for that. I just assumed that the other person broke the, you know, stopped the trajectory of the bullet or whatever, and he died as a result, and Avon was spared.
Yeah, I mean, it's a crazy, it's a great, I mean, not great, like it's, you know, tragic and like violent, but watching that, you know, I just took the first few times, like, holy, man, Chris is like, man, no wonder he's, I mean, we think he's in an awkward moment outside that Denali, as you say. I still think it could be not because the Yukon is a Yukon, just like, is a Denali an addition of a Yukon? I thought a Yukon's different. I think it's Yukon, but maybe it's a Yukon Denali.
Yeah, I think it's a GMC Yukon Denali.
Because, like, isn't Denali, like, National Park? It's not in the Yukon, though. That's, Denali's in Alaska, and Yukon's, like, a part of Canada. So what the hell is going on, GMC?
It's like you got to take it up with the car manufacturers.
Yeah, but, I mean, you know, we just see how cold and calculated he is. So Chris was, like, he's a sociopath. So
we get a good glimpse of how dangerous he is in this moment.
Yeah, just drive slow.
How much of a force of nature
he is. A force, man. Yeah. But so we've talked, you know, about Avon a little.
Yeah,
I mean, he's getting the worst of it. String is also he's struggling. But did we talk? I mean,
Brianna is blowing up Stringer's phone again and coming into his office and trying to, say that she needs to talk to Avon about what happened with D'Angelo, relaying the information that she learned from McNulty, and further illustrating how stupid Stringer's decision was to get D'Angelo killed on the inside and not expect any blowback or consequences from that. And we see the walls kind of closing in on him at that moment, and it's a beautiful thing to see with Idris Elba's acting, the way he deals with that.
Yeah, and Michael Hyatt, she's great. This is where, yeah, like the whole Golden Faucet with Clay's this episode, right?
Yeah,
crawl, walk, run. But so Stringer's not ready, but then the guy's like, all right, nah, you're cool. Is that basically how it goes down?
I think
like he's Clay's the FUD at faucet at HUD, and then it's like the guy's like, I don't know him, but after talking with Clay, it's like, all right, well, like, is he just gonna pay him off more?
Yeah, Clay's basically extorting him.
Jesus. Yeah. Extorting the HUD guy.
And I mean Stringer, right?
Yeah, he's extorting. He's basically like sabacking like Stringer.
Yeah.
Like pretty much how they were, like, you know, that whole thing. DiBiago and all that.
Right. But all of this culminates in the climactic scene with Avon and Stringer having like a existential crisis argument about like what it is they're meant to do with their life. Like after Avon survives that attack and he's planning his retaliation, and Stringer saying, you got to lay low. Like we're like on the brink of something big with these development contracts I've got going. And Avon, he refers to them as like the Trump brothers, but no, they're actually the Chump brothers. Like,
yeah,
which is funny because as we all know, Trump is actually a chump.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry to piss off all our MAGA fans out there.
Everyone out in Michigan or, you know.
But this leads into like a whole thing with Avon basically telling Stringer he's not man enough and like, you know, really hitting him where it hurts. And then Stringer just kind of like tortures him a little bit with the admission that he had his nephew killed in the jail and that like maybe he is like meant for it more than he thinks. They get into a scuffle and Stringer uses Avon's injury to his own personal advantage to kind of like, you know, put him in a submission so that like he can have the last word or whatever. And Avon comes away from it looking weak.
Yeah. I mean, definitely a fair fade there. Like that's, those are like, definitely like, state commission, athletic commission sanctioned moves, like digging in a wound and stuff.
Pretty brutal.
I mean, you mentioned there's a lot of toxic masculinity in this scene, which like seems to be pretty much, you know, it's a solid thesis regarding this show, right? It's pretty much all this, all turmoil is related back in some way to toxic masculinity.
Right.
And Stringer was giving him a good thrashing, you know, he's berating him about him being too old. He's kind of like maybe guys who go to South Beach for spring break still on their way. Like if you're rapping, drinking a bunch of, you know, like honey flavored Jack Daniels, it's probably too late. And Avon just needs, he needs something else to do, and
he's not looking at the bigger picture. Well, neither of them are, to be honest. It's just Stringer has too much false businessman confidence and thinks he is looking at the bigger picture, but can't even see that he's being conned by Clay and Krawczyk. So
yeah, they need to like cutty the tasks on. No, they need to cutty up the. No, I don't know, man.
All right.
They're failing. But crazy moment there.
Yeah. And then for the last little section going to dissect, we get into the whole City Hall politics angle with Carchetti doing a round two on dressing down Rawls and Burrell at one of these city council meetings.
Councilman Gray, Tony, right?
Yeah.
Tommy and Tony are like taking turns, right?
Right.
This is now his time to shine. It's just, you know, a lot of things being thrown around, the stat juking, all that stuff.
Yeah. But I mean, Rawls basically lies to him and says that they don't massage stats or they don't mess with anything when it's so obvious from the CompStat meetings that was the message that he sent to all his underlings to, you know, get the statistics under control, so to speak. But yeah, Carchetti and and Tony Gray are almost like kind of like an unspoken competition already at this point, where they both have their eyes on the mayor's seat and they're working at getting their shots in competitively. So
getting their squash in.
Exactly.
But yeah, I mean, this, like, you, I know you made some great points in the beginning of this season about Tommy's you know, kind of idealistic approach and coming off as maybe more progressive, but then in the long run falling far from that. And, you know, this is the whole, like, conversation, a nice setup for, like, oh, we don't massage the stats. And Rawls is, like you said, obviously a liar. And Tommy's so honest, like, he wants to be so honest, but in the long run, things won't necessarily pan out like that. I know you're better at, like, cataloging what's going to happen in the future. I get completely lost sometimes.
No, that's cool. But yeah, Terry D'Agostino is not totally happy with his approach, and that he's kind of being like a shark on this whole witness protection thing, and that he's only sticking to the facts, and he's not like using more of his political prowess to like up his charisma points or whatever.
Man, yeah, Clinton had facts. Even Reagan had them, man. So don't, no Reagan slander. No, like, what was Ibaka talking about? I mean, okay, union busting. Yes, but
yeah,
I don't know. I don't know where I'm going. I'm losing it, man.
At least he made people feel comfortable. Yeah, the charisma. I don't know.
I mean, exactly. You know,
which is like, yeah, which is what Terry is like trying to impart on Tommy from like a, you know, advisor's point of view for what she wants him to do to win this thing.
I want to come next time. I want there to be a monitor pulled up, like whatever you could feed. Like, hook up whatever you need to do. And I want to see, like, thumbnails of all of our episodes, like a video edition. And I want you to coach me on where, you know, like, the facts maybe weren't as necessary. It was about warmth.
Gotcha.
You know, where I missed the mark on that.
Yeah.
Just so we could be way more, you know, way more likable. Like, more of a fireside chat vibe instead of just, like, you know, getting wasted on facts, man. Just, like... Everyone's like, my brain is still in recovery mode from taking in all these high-level important ideas.
All right.
Yeah. Thanks for joining.
Yeah, thanks for sticking with us. As always, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at The Gods Will Not Save You. Same name across all platforms. We love interacting with you and all that, so please feel free.
Yeah, and also don't hesitate to reach out with questions. Send them to our email, and that's at thegodswillnotsaveyou@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you that way as well if you're not up on the social media.
Right. And thank you again to Mostart for doing the incredible intro and outro music and all the bumpers.
Yeah, check out his new stuff. Really interesting. Got to hear some previews. I got to be one of those. I got to put my... Whatever. I got to check it out too. But thanks to Andre Tessens as well. Great guy. In his own right, and you know, hooked it up with the nice emblem. So, very talented artist. Appreciate your work.
All right, thanks everybody. We'll see you next week.